Save big this holiday season. All in the Kroger app.
Buy two, get three free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up. Then get a flavorful Kroger spiral sliced ham for 89 cents a pound with an additional $25 purchase. Limit two, all with your card.
Shop these deals at your local Kroger today. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Letter 14 of A Lady's Life in the Rocky Mountains. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. A Lady's Life in the Rocky Mountains by Isabella L. Bird. Letter 14. Estes Park. I must attempt to put down the trifling events of each day just as they occur. The second time that I was left alone, Mr. Nugent came in looking very black, and asked me to ride with him to see the beaver dams on the Black Canyon. No more whistling or singing, or talking to his beautiful mare, or sparkling repartee. His mood was as dark as the sky overhead, which was black with an impending snowstorm. He was quite silent, struck his horse often, started off on a furious gallop, and then throwing his mare on her haunches close to me, said, "You're the first man or woman who's treated me like a human being for many a year." So he said in this dark mood, but Mr. and Mrs. Dewey, who took a very deep interest in his welfare, always treated him as a rational, intelligent gentleman, and in his better moments he spoke of them with the warmest appreciation. "If you want to know," he continued, "how nearly a man can become a devil, I'll tell you now. There was no choice, and we rode up the canyon, and I listened to one of the darkest tales of ruin I have ever heard or read. Its early features were very simple. His father was a British officer quartered at Montreal, of a good old Irish family. From his account, he was an ungovernable boy, imperfectly educated and tyrannizing over a loving but weak mother. When 17 years old, he saw a young girl at church whose appearance he described as being of angelic beauty, and fell in love with her with all the intensity of an uncontrolled nature. He saw her 3 times, but scarcely spoke to her. On his mother opposing his wish and treating it as a boyish folly, he took to drink, to spite her, and almost as soon as he was 18, maddened by the girl's death, he ran away from home, entered the service of the Hudson's Bay Company, and remained in it for several years, only leaving it because he found even that lawless life too strict for him. Then, being, as I supposed, about 27, he entered the service of the United States government, and became one of the famous Indian scouts of the plains, distinguishing himself by some of the most daring deeds on record, and some of the bloodiest crimes. Some of these tales I have heard before, but never so terribly told. Years must have passed in that service till he became a character known through all the West, and much dreaded for his readiness to take offense, and his equal readiness with his revolver. Vain, even in his dark mood, he told me that he was idolized by women, and that in his worst hours he was always chivalrous and good to women. He described himself as riding through camps in his scout's dress, with a red scarf round his waist, and 16 golden curls, 8 inches long, hanging over his shoulders. The handsome, even superbly handsome, side of his face was towards me as he spoke. As a scout, and as an armed escort of immigrant parties, he was evidently implicated in all the blood and broil of a lawless region and period, and went from bad to worse, varying his life by drunken sprees, which brought nothing but violence and loss. The narrative seemed to lack some link, for I next found him on a homestead in Missouri, from whence he came to Colorado a few years ago. There again something was dropped out, but I suspect, and not without reason, that he joined one or more of those gangs of border ruffians, which for so long raided through Kansas, perpetrating such massacres and outrages as that of the Mertezeen Scene. His fame for violence and ruffianism preceded him into Colorado, where his knowledge and love of the mountains have earned him the sobriquet he now wears. He has a squatter's claim and 40 head of cattle, and is a successful trapper besides, but envy and vindictiveness are raging within him. He gets money, goes to Denver, and spends large sums in the maddest dissipation, making himself a terror, and going beyond even such desperadoes as Texas Jack and Wild Bill, and when the money is done, returns to his mountain den, full of hatred and self-scorn, till the next time. Of course, I cannot give details. The story took 3 hours to tell, and was crowded with terrific illustrations of a desperado's career, told with a rush of wild eloquence that was truly thrilling. When the snow, which for some time had been falling, compelled him to break off and guide me to a sheltered place from which I could make my own way back again, he stopped his horse and said, "Now you see who has made a devil of himself. Lost, lost, lost. I believe in God. I've given him no choice but to put me with the devil and his angel. I'm afraid to die. You've stirred the better nature in me too late. I can't change. If ever a man were a slave, I am. Don't speak to me of repentance and reformation. I can't reform. Your voice reminded me of blank." Then in feverish tones, "How dare you ride with me? You won't speak to me again, will you?" He made me promise to keep one or two things secret, whether he were living or dead, and I promised, for I had no choice. But they come between me and the sunshine moments, and I wake at night to think of them. I wish I had been spared the regret and excitement of that afternoon. A less ungovernable nature would never have spoken as he did, nor told me what he did, but his proud, fierce soul all poured itself out then, with hatred and self-loathing, blood on his hands and murder in his heart, though even then he could not be altogether other than a gentleman, or altogether divest himself of fascination, even when so tempestuously revealing the darkest points of his character. My soul dissolved in pity for this dark, lost, self-ruined life, as he left me and turned away in the blinding storm to the snowy range, where he said he was going to camp out for a fortnight. A man of great abilities, real genius, singular gifts, and with all the chances in life which other men have had. How far more terrible than the actum est puristi of Cowper is his exclamation, "Lost, lost, lost." The storm was very severe, and the landmarks being blotted out, I lost my way in the snow, and when I reached the cabin after dark, I found it still empty, for the two hunters, on returning, finding that I had gone out, had gone in search of me. The snow cleared off late, and intense frost set in. My room is nearly the open air, being built of unchinked logs, and, as in the open air, one requires to sleep with the head buried in blankets, or the eyelids and breath freeze. The sunshine has been brilliant today. I took a most beautiful ride to Black Canyon to look for the horses. Every day some new beauty or effect of snow and light is to be seen. Nothing that I have seen in Colorado compares with Estes Park, and now that the weather is magnificent and the mountain tops above the pine woods are pure white, there is nothing of beauty or grandeur for which the heart can wish that is not here. And it is health-giving, with pure air, pure water, and absolute dryness. But there is something very solemn, at times almost overwhelming, in the winter solitude. I have never experienced anything like it even when I lived on the slopes of Hualalai. When the men are out hunting, I know not where, or at night, when storms sweep down the Long's Peak, and the air is full of stinging, tempest-driven snow, and there is barely a probability of anyone coming, or of my communication with the world at all, then the stupendous mountain ranges which lie between us and the plains grow in height till they become impassable barriers, and the bridgeless rivers grow in depth, and I wonder if all my life is to be spent here in washing and sweeping and baking. Today has been one of manual labor. We did not breakfast till 9:30, then the men went out, and I never sat down till 2. I cleaned the living room and the kitchen, swept a path through the rubbish in the passage room, washed up, made and baked a batch of rolls and 4 pounds of sweet biscuits, cleaned some tins and pans, washed some clothes, and gave things generally a redding up. There is a little thick buttermilk, fully 6 weeks old, at the bottom of a churn, which I use for raising the rolls. But Mr. Cavan, who makes lovely bread, put some flour and water to turn sour near the stove, and this succeeds admirably. I also made an unsatisfactory investigation into the state of my apparel. I came to Colorado now, nearly 3 months ago, with a small carpet bag containing clothes, none of them new, and these, by legitimate wear, the depredations of calves, and the necessity of tearing some of them up for dishcloths, are reduced to a single change. I have a solitary pocket handkerchief and 1 pair of stockings, such a mass of darns that hardly a trace of the original wool remains. Owing to my inability to get money in Denver, I am almost without shoes, having nothing but a pair of slippers and some arctics. For outer garments, well, I have a trained black silk dress, with a black silk polonaise, and nothing else but my old flannel riding suit, which is quite threadbare, and requires such frequent mending that I am sometimes obliged to dress for supper, and patch and darn it during the evening. You will laugh, but it is singular that one can face the bitter winds with the mercury at 0, and below it, in exactly the same clothing which I wore in the tropics. It is only the extreme dryness of the air which renders it possible to live in such clothing. We have arranged the work better. Mr. Buchan was doing too much, and it was hard for him, as he is very delicate. You will wonder how 3 people here in the wilderness can have much to do. There are the horses which we keep in the corral, to feed on sheaf oats and take to water 2 times a day, the fowls and dogs to feed, the cow to milk, the bread to make, and to keep a general knowledge of the whereabouts of the stock in the event of a severe snowstorm coming on. Then there is all the wood to cut, and there is no woodpile, and we burn a great deal, and besides the cooking, washing, and mending, which each one does, the men must hunt and fish for their living. Then 2 sick cows have had to be attended to. We were with one when it died yesterday. It suffered terribly, and looked at us with the pathetically pleading eyes of a creature made subject to vanity. The disposal of its carcass was a difficulty. The wagon horses were in Denver, and when we tried to get the others to pull the dead beast away, they only kicked and plunged, so we managed to get it outside the shed, and according to Mr. Cavan's prediction, a pack of wolves came down, and before daylight nothing was left but the bones. They were so close to the cabin that their noise was most disturbing, and on looking out several times I could see them all in a heap, wrangling and tumbling over each other. They are much larger than the prairie wolf, but equally cowardly, I believe. This morning was black with clouds, and a snowstorm was threatened, and about 700 cattle and a number of horses came in long files from the valleys and canyons where they maraud, their instinct teaching them to seek the open and the protection of man. I was alone in the cabin this afternoon when Mr. Nugent, whom we believed to be on the snowy range, walked in very pale and haggard-looking, and coughing severely. He offered to show me the trail up one of the grandest of the canyons, and I could not refuse to go. The Fall River has had its source completely altered by the operations of the beavers. Their engineering skill is wonderful. In one place they have made a lake by damming up the stream, in another their works have created an island, and they have made several falls. Their storehouses, of course, are carefully concealed. By this time they are about full for the winter. We saw quantities of young cottonwood and aspen trees, with stems about as thick as my arm, lying where these industrious creatures have felled them, ready for their use. They always work at night, and in concert. Their long, sharp teeth are used for gnawing down the trees, but their mason work is done entirely with their flat, trowel-like tails. In its natural state, the fur is very durable and is as full of long black hairs as that of the sable, but as sold, all these hairs have been plucked out of it. The canyon was glorious, ah, glorious beyond any other, but it was a dismal and depressing ride. The dead, past buried, its dead. Not an allusion was made to the conversation previously. Jim's manner was courteous, but freezing. And when I left home on my return, he said he hardly thought he should be back from the snowy range before I left. Essentially an actor, was he, I wonder, posing on the previous day in the attitude of desperate remorse, to impose on my credulity or frighten me? Or was it a genuine and unpremeditated outburst of passionate regret for the life which he had thrown away? I cannot tell, but I think it was the last. As I cautiously rode back, the sunset glories were reddening the mountain tops, and the park lay in violet gloom. It was wonderfully magnificent, but oh, so solemn, so lonely. I rode a very large, well-bred mare, with three shoes loose and one off, and she fell with me twice and was very clumsy in crossing the Thompson, which was partly ice and partly a deep ford. But when we reached comparatively level grassy ground, I had a gallop of nearly 2 miles which I enjoyed thoroughly, her great swinging stride being so easy and exhilarating after Birdie's short action. Friday. This is a piteous day, quite black, freezing hard, and with a fierce northeast wind. The absence of sunshine here, where it is nearly perpetual, has a very depressing effect, and all the scenery appears in its grimness of black and gray. We have lost 3 horses, including Birdie, and have nothing to entice them with, and not an animal to go and drive them in with. I put my great mare in the corral myself, and Mr. Cavan put his in afterwards and secured the bars, but the wolves were holding a carnival again last night, and we think that the horses were scared and stampeded, as otherwise they would not have leaped the fence. The men are losing their whole day in looking for them. On their return, they said that they had seen Mr. Nugent returning to his cabin by the other side and the lower ford of the Thompson, and that he had an awfully ugly fit on him, so that they were glad that he did not come near us. The evening is setting in sublime in its blackness. Late in the afternoon, I caught a horse which was snuffing at the sheaf-oats, and had a splendid gallop on the Longmount trail with the 2 great hunting dogs. In returning, in the grimness of the coming storm, I had that view of the park which I saw first in the glories of an autumn sunset. Life was all dead. The dragonflies no longer darted in the sunshine. The cottonwoods had shed their last amber leaves. The crimson trailers of the wild vines were bare. The stream itself had ceased its tinkle and was numb in the fetters of ice. A few withered flower stalks only told of the brief, bright glory of the summer. The park never had looked so utterly walled in. It was fearful in its loneliness. The ghastliest of white peaks lay sharply outlined against the black snow clouds. The bright river was ice-bound. The pines were all black. The world was absolutely shut out. How can you expect me to write letters from such a place, from a life in which nothing happens? It really is strange that neither Evans nor Edwards come back. The young men are grumbling, for they were asked to stay here for 5 days, and they have been here 5 weeks, and they are anxious to be away, camping out for the hunting, on which they depend. There are 2 calves dying, and we don't know what to do for them. And if a very severe snowstorm comes on, we can't bring in and feed 800 head of cattle. Saturday. The snow began to fall early this morning, and as it is unaccompanied by wind, we have the novel spectacle of a smooth white world. Still, it does not look like anything serious. We have been gradually growing later at night and later in the morning. Today we did not breakfast till 10. We have been becoming so disgusted with the pickled pork that we were glad to find it just at an end yesterday, even though we were left without meat for which in this climate the system craves. You can fancy my surprise on going into the kitchen to find a dish of smoking steaks of venison on the table. We ate like famished people, and enjoyed our meal thoroughly. Just before I came, the young men had shot an elk, which they intended to sell in Denver, and the grand carcass, with great branching antlers, hung outside the shed. Often, while vainly trying to swallow some pickled pork, I had looked across to the tantalizing animal, but it was not to be thought of. However, this morning, as the young men felt the pinch of hunger even more than I did, and the prospects of packing it to Denver became worse, they decided on cutting into one side, so we shall luxuriate in venison while it lasts. We think that Edwards will surely be up tonight, but unless he brings supplies, our case is looking serious. The flour is running low. There is only coffee for 1 week, and I have only a scanty 3 ounces of tea left. The baking powder is nearly at an end. We have agreed to economize by breakfasting very late, and having 2 meals a day instead of 3. The young men went out hunting as usual, and I went out and found Birdie, and on her brought in 4 other horses. But the snow balled so badly that I went out and walked across the river on a very passable ice bridge, and got some new views of the unique grandeur of this place. Our evenings are social and pleasant. We finish supper about 8 and make up a huge fire. The men smoke while I write to you. Then we draw near the fire, and I take my endless mending, and we talk or read aloud. Both are very intelligent, and Mr. Buchan has very extended information and a good deal of insight into character. Of course, our circumstances, the likelihood of release, the prospects of snow blocking us in, and of our supplies holding out, the sick calves, Jim's mood, the possible intentions of a man whose footprints we have found and traced for 3 miles, are all topics that often recur, and few of which can be worn threadbare. End of letter 14. Letter 15 of A Lady's Life in the Rocky Mountains. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. A Lady's Life in the Rocky Mountains by Isabella L. Bird. Letter 15. Estes Park, Sunday. A trapper passing last night brought us the news that Mr. Nugent is ill. So after washing up the things after our late breakfast, I rode to his cabin, but I met him in the gulch coming down to see us. He said he had caught cold on the range and was suffering from an old arrow wound in the lung. We had a long conversation without adverting to the former one, and he told me some of the present circumstances of his ruined life. It is piteous that a man like him, in the prime of life, should be destitute of home and love, and live a life of darkness in a den with no companions but guilty memories, and a dog, which many people think is the nobler animal of the two. I urged him to give up the whiskey, which at present is his ruin, and his answer had the ring of a sad truth in it. I cannot. It binds me hand and foot. I cannot give up the only pleasure I have. His ideas of right are the queerest possible. He says that he believes in God, but what he knows or believes of God's law, I know not. To resent insult with your revolver, to revenge yourself on those who have injured you, to be true to a comrade and share your last crust with him, to be chivalrous to good women, to be generous and hospitable, and at the last to die game, these are the articles of his creed, and I suppose they are received by men of his stamp. He hates Evans with a bitter hatred, and Evans returns it, having undergone much provocation from Jim in his moods of lawlessness and violence, and being not a little envious of the fascination which his manners and conversation have for the strangers who come up here. On returning down the gulch, the view was grander than I have ever seen it, the gulch in dark shadow, the park below lying in intense sunlight, with all the majestic canyons which sweep down upon it in depths of infinite blue gloom, and above, the pearly peaks, dazzling in purity and glorious in form, cleft the turquoise blue of the sky. How shall I ever leave this land which is very far off? How can I ever leave it? Is the real question. We are going on the principle, let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die, and the stores are melting away. The two meals are not an economical plan, for we are so much more hungry that we eat more than when we had three. We had a good deal of sacred music today, to make it as like Sunday as possible. The faint melancholy of this winter loneliness is very fascinating. How glorious the amber fires of the winter dawns are, and how gloriously tonight the crimson clouds descended just to the mountain tops and were reflected on the pure surface of the snow. The door of this room looks due north, and as I write, the pole star blazes, and a cold crescent moon hangs over the ghastliness of Long's Peak. Estes Park, Colorado, November. We have lost count of time, and can only agree on the fact that the date is somewhere near the end of November. Our life has settled down into serenity, and our singular and enforced partnership is very pleasant. We might be three men living together, but for the unvarying courtesy and consideration which they show to me. Our work goes on like clockwork. The only difficulty which ever arises is that the men do not like me to do anything that they think hard or unsuitable, such as saddling a horse or bringing in water. The days go very fast. It was 3:30 today before I knew that it was 1. It is a calm life without worries. The men are so easy to live with. They never fuss or grumble or sigh or make a trouble of anything. It would amuse you to come into our wretched little kitchen before our disgracefully late breakfast and find Mr. Cavan busy at the stove frying venison, myself washing the supper dishes, and Mr. Buchan drying them, or both the men busy at the stove while I sweep the floor. Our food is a great object of interest to us, and we are ravenously hungry now that we have only 2 meals a day. About sundown, each goes forth to his chores, Mr. K. to chop wood, Mr. B. to haul water, I to wash the milk pans and water the horses. On Saturday the men shot a deer, and on going for it today they found nothing but the hind legs, and following a track which they expected would lead them to a beast's hole, they came quite carelessly upon a large mountain lion, which, however, took itself out of their reach before they were sufficiently recovered from their surprise to fire at it. These lions, which are really a species of puma, are bloodthirsty as well as cowardly. Lately one got into a sheepfold in the canyon of the St. Vrain and killed 30 sheep, sucking the blood from their throats. November. This has been a day of minor events, as well as a busy one. I was so busy that I never sat down from 10:30 till 1:30. I had washed my one change of raiment, and though I never iron my clothes, I like to bleach them till they are as white as snow, and they were whitening on the line when some furious gust came down from Long's Peak, against which I could not stand, and when I did get out, all my clothes were blown into strips from 1 inch to 4 inches in width, literally destroyed. One learns how very little is necessary, either for comfort or happiness. I made a 4-pound spiced ginger cake, baked some bread, mended my riding dress, cleaned up generally, wrote some letters with the hope that some day they might be posted, and took a magnificent walk. Reached the cabin again in the melancholy glory which now immediately precedes the darkness. We were all busy getting our supper ready when the dogs began to bark furiously, and we heard the noise of horses. "Evans at last!" we exclaimed. But we were wrong. Mr. Cavan went out, and returned, saying that it was a young man who had come up with Evans' wagon and team, and that the wagon had gone over a gulch 7 miles from here. Mr. Cavan looked very grave. "It's another mouth to feed," he said. They asked no questions and brought the lad in, a slangy, assured fellow of 20. who, having fallen into delicate health at a theological college, had been sent up here by Evans to work for his board. The men were too courteous to ask him what he was doing up here, but I boldly asked him where he lived, and to our dismay he replied, "I've come to live here." We discussed the food question gravely, as it presented a real difficulty. We put him into a bed closet opening from the kitchen, and decided to see what he was fit for before giving him work. We were very much amazed, in truth, at his coming here. He is evidently a shallow, arrogant youth. We have decided that today is November 26th. Tomorrow is Thanksgiving Day, and we are planning a feast, though Mr. K. said to me again this morning with a doleful face, "You see, there's another mouth to feed." This mouth has come up to try the panacea of manual labor. But he is town bred, and I see that he will do nothing. He is writing poetry, and while I was busy today, began to read it aloud to me, asking for my criticism. He is just at the age when everything literary has a fascination, and every literary person is a hero, especially Dr. Holland. Last night was fearful from the lifting of the cabin and the breaking of the mud from the roof. We sat with fine gravel driving in our faces, and this morning I carried 4 shovelfuls of mud out of my room. After breakfast, Mr. Cavan, Mr. Lyman, and I, with the 2 wagon horses, rode the 7 miles to the scene of yesterday's disaster in a perfect gale of wind. I felt like a servant going out for a day's pleasuring, hurrying through my dishes and leaving my room in disorder. The wagon lay halfway down the side of a ravine, kept from the destruction by having caught on some trees. It was too cold to hang out while the men hauled it up and fixed it, so I went slowly back, encountering Mr. Nugent in a most bitter mood, almost in an ugly fit, hating everybody and contrasting his own generosity and reckless kindness with the selfishness and carefully weighed kindness of others. People do give him credit for having as kind a heart as ever beat. Lately a child in the other cabin was taken ill, and though there were idle men on horses at hand, it was only the desperado, who rode 60 miles in the shortest time ever made, to bring the doctor. While we were talking, he was sitting on a stone outside his den, mending a saddle, shins, bones, and skulls lying about him. Ring, watching him with jealous and idolatrous affection, the wind shifting his thin curls from as grand a head as was ever molded, a ruin of a man. Yet the sun which shines on the evil and the good was lighting up the gold of his hair. May our Father which is in heaven yet show mercy to his outcast child. Mr. Cavan soon overtook me, and we had an exciting race of 2 miles, getting home just before the wind fell and the snow began. Thanksgiving Day. The thing dreaded has come at last, a snowstorm, with a northeast wind. It ceased about midnight, but not till it had covered my bed. Then the mercury fell below zero, and everything froze. I melted a tin of water for washing by the fire, but it was hard frozen before I could use it. My hair, which was thoroughly wet with the thawed snow of yesterday, is hard frozen in plaits. The milk and treacle are like rock. The eggs have to be kept on the coolest part of the stove to keep them fluid. 2 calves in the shed were frozen to death. Half our floor is deep in snow, and it is so cold that we cannot open the door to shovel it out. The snow began again at 8 this morning, very fine and hard. It blows in through the chinks and dusts this letter while I write. Mr. Cavan keeps my ink bottle close to the fire and hands it to me every time that I need to dip my pen. We have a huge fire, but cannot raise the temperature above 20 degrees. Ever since I returned, the lake has been hard enough to bear a wagon, but today it is difficult to keep the water hole open by the constant use of the axe. The snow may either melt or block us in. Our only anxiety is about the supplies. We have tea and coffee enough to last us over tomorrow. The sugar is just done, and the flour is getting low. It is really serious that we have another mouth to feed, and the newcomer is a ravenous creature, eating more than the three of us. It dismays me to see his hungry eyes gauging the supply at breakfast, and to see the loaf disappear. He told me this morning that he could eat the whole of what was on the table. He is mad after food, and I can see that Mr. K. is starving himself to make it hold out. Mr. Buchan is very far from well, and dreads the prospect of half rations. All this sounds laughable, but we shall not laugh if we have to look hunger in the face. Now in the evening, the snow clouds, which have blotted out all things, are lifting, and the winter scene is wonderful. The mercury is 5 degrees below zero, and the aurora is glorious. In my unchinked room, the mercury is 1 degrees below zero. Mr. Buchan can hardly get his breath. The dryness is intense. We spent the afternoon cooking the Thanksgiving dinner. I made a wonderful pudding, for which I had saved eggs and cream for days, and dried and stoned cherries supplied the place of currants. I made a bowl of custard for sauce, which the men said was splendid. Also a rolled pudding with molasses. And we had venison steak and potatoes. But for tea, we were obliged to use the tea leaves of the morning again. I should think that few people in America have enjoyed their Thanksgiving dinner more. We had urged Mr. Nugent to join us, but he refused, almost savagely, which we regretted. My 4-pound cake made yesterday is all gone. This wretched boy confesses that he was so hungry in the night that he got up and ate nearly half of it. He is trying to cajole me into making another. November 29th. Before the boy came, I had mistaken some faded cayenne pepper for ginger, and had made a cake with it. Last evening I put half of it into the cupboard and left the door open. During the night we heard a commotion in the kitchen, and much choking, coughing, and groaning, and at breakfast the boy was unable to swallow food with his usual ravenousness. After breakfast he came to me whimpering, and asking for something soothing for his throat, admitting that he had seen the gingerbread, and felt so starved in the night that he got up to eat it. I tried to make him feel that it was real mean to eat so much and be so useless, and he said he would do anything to help me, but the men were so down on him. I never saw men so patient with a lad before. He is a most vexing addition to our party, yet one cannot help laughing at him. He is not honorable, though. I dare not leave this letter lying on the table, as he would read it. He writes for 2 Western periodicals, at least he says so, and he shows us long pieces of his published poetry. In one there are 20 lines copied, as Mr. Cavan has shown me, without alteration from Paradise Lost. In another there are 2 stanzas from Resignation, with only the alteration of Stray for Dead. And he has passed the whole of Bonner's Meeting Place off as his own. Again, he lent me an essay by himself, called The Function of the Novelist, which is nothing but a mosaic of unacknowledged quotations. The men tell me that he has bragged to them that on his way here he took shelter in Mr. Nugent's cabin, found out where he hides his key, opened his box, and read his letters and manuscripts. He is a perfect plague with his ignorance and self-sufficiency. The first day after he came, while I was washing up the breakfast things, he told me that he intended to do all the dirty work, so I left the knives and forks in the tub and asked him to wipe and lay them aside. 2 hours afterwards, I found them untouched. Again the men went out hunting, and he said he would chop the wood for several days' use, and after a few strokes, which were only successful in chipping off some shavings, he came in and strummed on the harmonium, leaving me without any wood with which to make the fire for supper. He talked about his skill with the lasso, but could not even catch one of our quietest horses. Worse than all, he does not know one cow from another. 2 days ago he lost our milch cow in driving her in to be milked, and Mr. Cavan lost hours of valuable time in hunting for her without success. Today he told us triumphantly that he had found her, and he was sent out to milk her. After 2 hours he returned with a rueful face and a few drops of whitish fluid in the milk pail, saying that that was all he could get. On Mr. K going out, he found, instead of our calico cow, a brindled one that had been dry since the spring. Our cow has gone off to the wild cattle, and we are looking very grim at Lyman, who says that he expected he should live on milk. I told him to fill up the 4-gallon kettle, and an hour afterwards found it red-hot on the stove. Nothing can be kept from him, unless it is hidden in my room. He has eaten 2 pounds of dried cherries from the shelf, half of my second 4-pound spice loaf before it was cold, licked up my custard sauce in the night, and privately devoured the pudding which was to be for our supper. He confesses it all, and says, "I suppose you think me a cure." Mr. K. says that the first thing he said to him this morning was, "Will Miss B. make us a nice pudding today?" This is all harmless, but the plagiarism and want of honor are disgusting, and quite out of keeping with his profession of being a theological student. This life is in some respects like being on board ship. There are no mails, and one knows nothing beyond one's little world, a very little one in this case. We find each other true, and have learnt to esteem and trust each other. I should, for instance, go out of this room leaving this book open on the table, knowing that the men would not read my letter. They are discreet, reticent, observant, and on many subjects well informed. But they are of a type which has no antitype at home. All women work in this region, so there is no fuss about my working, or saying, "Oh, you mustn't do that," or, "Oh, let me do that." November 30th. We sat up till 11 last night, so confident were we that Edwards would leave Denver the day after Thanksgiving and get up here. This morning we came to the resolution that we must break up. Tea, coffee, and sugar are done. The venison is turning sour, and the men have only 1 month left for the hunting on which their winter living depends. I cannot leave the territory till I get money, but I can go to Longmount for the mail and hear whether the panic is abating. Yesterday I was alone all day, and after riding to the base of Long's Peak, made 2 roly-poly puddings for supper, having nothing else. The men, however, came back perfectly loaded with trout, and we had a feast. Epicures at home would have envied us. Mr. Cavan kept the frying pan with boiling butter on the stove, butter enough thoroughly to cover the trout, rolled them in coarse cornmeal, plunged them into the butter, turned them once, and took them out, thoroughly done, fizzing and lemon-colored. For once young Lyman was satisfied, for the dish was replenished as often as it was emptied. They caught 40 pounds, and have packed them in ice until they can be sent to Denver for sale. The winter fishing is very rich. In the hardest frost, men who fish not for sport but gain take their axes and camping blankets, and go up to the hard-frozen waters, which lie in 50 places round the park, and choosing a likely spot, a little sheltered from the wind, hack a hole in the ice, and fastening a foot-link to a cottonwood tree, bait the hook with maggots or bits of easily gotten fresh meat. Often the trout are caught as fast as the hook can be baited, and looking through the ice-hole in the track of a sunbeam, you see a mass of tails, silver fins, bright eyes, and crimson spots, a perfect shoal of fish, and truly beautiful the crimson-spotted creatures look, lying still and dead on the blue ice under the sunshine. Sometimes 2 men bring home 60 pounds of trout as the result of one day's winter fishing. It is a cold and silent sport, however. How a cook at home would despise our scanty appliances, with which we turn out luxuries. We have only a cooking stove, which requires incessant feeding with wood, a kettle, a frying pan, a 6-gallon brass pan, and a bottle for a rolling pin. The cold has been very severe, but I do not suffer from it even in my insufficient clothing. I take a piece of granite made very hot to bed, draw the blankets over my head, and sleep 8 hours, though the snow often covers me. One day of snow, mist, and darkness was rather depressing, and yesterday a hurricane began about 5 in the morning, and the whole park was one swirl of drifting snow, like stinging wood smoke. My bed and room were white, and the frost was so intense that water brought in a kettle hot from the fire froze as I poured it into the basin. Then the snow ceased, and a fierce wind blew most of it out of the park, lifting it from the mountains in such clouds as to make Long's Peak look like a smoking volcano. Today the sky has resumed its delicious blue, and the park its unrivaled beauty. I have cleaned all the windows, which ever since I have been here I supposed were of discolored glass, so opaque and dirty they were, and when the men came home from fishing they found a cheerful new world. We had a great deal of sacred music and singing on Sunday. Mr. Buchan asked me if I knew a tune called America, and began the grand roll of our national anthem to the words, "My country tis of thee, sweet land of liberty." December 1st. I was to have started for Canyon today, but was awoke by snow, as stinging as pinpoints beating on my hand. We all got up early, but it did not improve until nearly noon. In the afternoon, Lyman and I rode to Mr. Nugent's cabin. I wanted him to read and correct my letter to you, giving the account of our ascent of Long's Peak, but he said he could not, and insisted on our going in, for which young Lyman was more anxious than I was, as Mr. Cavan had seen Jim in the morning, and departed from his usual reticence so far as to say, "There's something wrong with that man. He'll either shoot himself or somebody else." However, the ugly fit had passed off, and he was so very pleasant and courteous that we remained the whole afternoon. Lyman's one thought was that he could make capital out of the interview and write an account of the celebrated desperado for a Western paper. The interior of the den was frightful, yet among his black and hideous surroundings, the grace of his manner and the genius of his conversation were only more apparent. I read my letter aloud, or rather, the ascent of Long's Peak, which I have written for Our West, and was sincerely interested with the taste and acumen of his criticisms on the style. He is a true child of nature. His eye brightened, and his whole face became radiant, and at last tears rolled down his cheek when I read the account of the glory of the sunrise. Then he read us a very able paper on spiritualism, which he was writing. The den was dense with smoke, and very dark, littered with hay, old blankets, skins, bones, tins, logs, powder flasks, magazines, old books, old moccasins, horseshoes, and relics of all kinds. He had no better seat to offer me than a log, but offered it with a graceful unconsciousness that it was anything less luxurious than an easy chair. Two valuable rifles and a Sharp's revolver hung on the wall, and the sash and badge of a scout. I could not help looking at Jim as he stood talking to me. He goes mad with drink at times, swears fearfully, has an ungovernable temper. He has formerly led a desperate life, and is at times, even now, undoubtedly a ruffian. There is hardly a fireside in Colorado where fearful stories of him as an Indian fighter are not told. Mothers frighten their naughty children by telling them that Mountain Jim will get them. And doubtless his faults are glaring, but he is undoubtedly fascinating, and enjoys a popularity or notoriety which no other person has. He offered to be my guide to the plains when I go away. Lyman asked me if I should not be afraid of being murdered. But one could not be safer than with him, I have often been told. The cold was truly awful. I had caught a chill in the morning from putting on my clothes before they were dry, and the warmth of the smoky den was most agreeable. But we had a fearful ride back in the dusk, a gale nearly blowing us off our horses, driving snow nearly blinding us, and the mercury below zero. I felt as if I were going to be laid up with a severe cold, but the men suggested a trapper's remedy, a tumbler of hot water with a pinch of cayenne pepper in it, which proved a very rapid cure. They kindly say that if the snow detains me here, they also will remain. They tell me that they were horrified when I arrived, as they thought that they could not make me comfortable, and that I had never been used to doing anything for myself. And then we complimented each other all round. Tomorrow, weather permitting, I set off for a ride of 100 miles, and my next letter will be my last from the Rocky Mountains. ILB. End of letter 15. Letter 16 of A Lady's Life in the Rocky Mountains. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. A Lady's Life in the Rocky Mountains by Isabella L. Bird. Letter 16. Dr. Hughes's, Lower Canyon, Colorado, December 4th. Once again here, in refined and cultured society, with harmonious voices about me, and dear, sweet, loving children, whose winning ways make this cabin a true English home. England, with all thy faults, I love thee still. I can truly say, where'er I roam, whatever realms I see, my heart, untraveled, fondly turns to thee. If it swerved a little in the Sandwich Islands, it is true to the pole now. Surely one advantage of traveling is that, while it removes much prejudice against foreigners and their customs, it intensifies tenfold one's appreciation of the good at home, and above all, of the quietness and purity of English domestic life. These reflections are forced upon me by the sweet child voices about me, and by the exquisite consideration and tenderness which are the atmosphere, some would call it the hothouse atmosphere, of this house. But with the bare, hard life and the bare, bleak mountains around, who could find fault with even a hothouse atmosphere, if it can nourish such a flower of paradise as sacred human love? The mercury is 11 degrees below zero, and I have to keep my ink on the stove to prevent it from freezing. The cold is intense, a clear, brilliant, stimulating cold, so dry that even in my threadbare flannel riding dress I do not suffer from it. I must now take up my narrative of the nothings which have all the interest of somethings to me. We all got up before daybreak on Tuesday, and breakfasted at 7. I have not seen the dawn for some time, with its amber fires deepening into red, and the snow peaks flushing one by one, and it seemed a new miracle. It was a west wind, and we all thought it promised well. I took only 2 pounds of luggage, some raisins, the mail bag, and an additional blanket under my saddle. I had not been up from the park at sunrise before, and it was quite glorious, the purple depths of McGinn's Gulch, from which at a height of 9,000 feet you look down on the sunlit park, 1,500 feet below, lying in a red haze, with its pearly needle-shaped peaks, framed by mountainsides dark with pines. My glorious, solitary, unique mountain home. The purple sun rose in front. Had I known what made it purple, I should certainly have gone no farther. Then clouds, the morning mist as I supposed, lifted themselves up, rose-lighted, showing the sun's disk as purple as one of the jars in a chemist's window, and having permitted this glimpse of their king, came down again as a dense mist, the wind chopped round, and the mist began to freeze hard. Soon Bertie and myself were a mass of acicular crystals. It was a true easterly fog. I galloped on, hoping to get through it, unable to see a yard before me, but it thickened, and I was obliged to subside into a jog trot. As I rode on, about 4 miles from the cabin, a human figure, looking gigantic like the spectre of the Brocken, with long hair, white as snow, appeared close to me, and at the same moment there was the flash of a pistol close to my ear, and I recognized Mountain Jim, frozen from head to foot, looking a century old with his snowy hair. It was ugly altogether, certainly, a desperado's grim jest, and it was best to accept it as such, though I had just cause for displeasure. He stormed and scolded, dragged me off my pony, for my hands and feet were numb with cold, took the bridle, and went off at a rapid stride, so that I had to run to keep them in sight in the darkness, for we were off the road in a thicket of scrub, looking like white branch coral, I knew not where. Then we came suddenly on his cabin, and dear old Ring, white like all else, and the ruffian insisted on my going in, and he made a good fire, and heated some coffee, raging all the time. He said everything against me going forward, except that it was dangerous. All he said came true, and here I am, safe. Your letters, however, outweighed everything but danger, and I decided on going on, when he said, "I've seen many foolish people, but never one so foolish as you. You haven't a grain of sense. Why, I, an old mountaineer, wouldn't go down to the plains today." I told him he could not, though he would like it very much, for that he had turned his horses loose, on which he laughed heartily, and more heartily still at the stories I told him of young Lyman, so that I have still a doubt how much of the dark moods I have lately seen was assumed. He took me back to the track, and the interview which began with a pistol shot ended quite pleasantly. It was an eerie ride, one not to be forgotten, though there was no danger. I could not recognize any localities. Every tree was silvered, and the fir-tree tufts of needles looked like white chrysanthemums. The snow lay a foot deep in the gulches, with its hard, smooth surface marked by the feet of innumerable birds and beasts. Ice bridges had formed across all the streams, and I crossed them without knowing when. Gulches looked fathomless abysses, with clouds boiling up out of them, and shaggy mountain summits, half seen for a moment through the eddies, as quickly vanished. Everything looked vast and indefinite. Then a huge creation, like one of the Doors' phantom illustrations, with much breathing of wings, came sailing towards me in a temporary opening in the mist. As with a strange rustle it passed close over my head, I saw, for the first time, the great mountain eagle, carrying a good-sized beast in his talons. It was a noble vision. Then there were 10 miles of metamorphosed gulches, silent, awful, many ice bridges, then a frozen drizzle, and then the winds changed from the east to northeast. Birdie was covered with exquisite crystals, and her long mane and the long beard which covers her throat were pure white. I saw that I must give up crossing the mountains to this place by an unknown trail, and I struck the old trail to the St. Vrain, which I had never traveled before, but which I knew to be more legible than the new one. The fog grew darker and thicker, the day colder and windier, the drifts deeper. But Birdie, whose 4 cunning feet had carried me 600 miles, and who in all difficulties proves her value, never flinched or made a false step, or gave me reason to be sorry that I had come on. I got down to St. Vrain Canyon in good time, and stopped at a house 13 miles from Longmount to get oats. I was white from head to foot, and my clothes were frozen stiff. The women gave me the usual invitation, "Put your feet in the oven," and I got my clothes thawed and dried, and a delicious meal consisting of a basin of cream and bread. They said it would be worse on the plains, for it was an easterly storm, but as I was so used to riding, I could get on, so we started at 2:30. Not far off, I met Edwards going up at last to Estes Park, and soon after the snowstorm began in earnest, or rather I entered the storm, which had been going on there for several hours. By that time I had reached the prairie, only 8 miles from Longmount, and pushed on. It was simply fearful. It was twilight from the thick snow, and I faced a furious east wind loaded with fine, hard frozen crystals, which literally made my face bleed. I could only see a very short distance anywhere. The drifts were often 2 feet deep, and only now and then, through the blinding whirl, I caught a glimpse of snow, through which withered sunflowers did not protrude, and then I knew I was on the track. But reaching a wild place, I lost it, and still cantered on, trusting to the pony's sagacity. It failed for once, for she took me on a lake, and we fell through the ice into the water, 100 yards from land, and had a hard fight back again. It grew worse and worse. I had wrapped up my face, but the sharp, hard snow beat on my eyes, the only exposed part, bringing tears into them, which froze and closed up my eyelids at once. You cannot imagine what that was. I had to take off one glove to pick one eye open, for as to the other, the storm beat so savagely against it that I left it frozen, and drew over it the double piece of flannel which protected my face. I could hardly keep the other open by picking the ice from it constantly with my numb fingers, in doing which I got the back of my hand slightly frostbitten. It was truly awful at the time. I often thought, suppose I am going south instead of east? Suppose Birdie should fall? Suppose it should grow quite dark? I was mountaineer enough to shake these fears off and keep up my spirits, but I knew how many had perished on the prairie in similar storms. I calculated that if I did not reach Longmount in half an hour, it would be quite dark, and that I should be so frozen or paralyzed with cold that I should fall off. Not a quarter of an hour after, I had wondered how long I could hold on, I saw, to my surprise, close to me, half smothered in snow, the scattered houses and blessed lights of Longmount, and welcome indeed its white, dreary, lifeless, soundless road looked. When I reached the hotel, I was so benumbed that I could not get off, and the worthy host lifted me off and carried me in. Not expecting any travelers, they had no fire except in the bar room, so they took me to the stove in their own room, gave me a hot drink and plenty of blankets, and in half an hour I was all right and ready for a ferocious meal. "If there's a traveler on the prairie tonight, God help him," the host had said to his wife just before I came in. I found Evans there, storm-stayed, and that, to his great credit at the time, my money matters were all right. After the sound and refreshing sleep which one gets in this splendid climate, I was ready for an early start, but warned by yesterday's experience, waited till 12 to be sure of the weather. The air was intensely clear, and the mercury 17 degrees below zero. The snow sparkled and snapped under one's feet. It was gloriously beautiful. In this climate, if you only go out for a short time, you do not feel cold even without a hat, or any additional wrappings. I bought a cardigan for myself, however, and some thick socks, got some stout snowshoes for Birdie's hind feet, had a pleasant talk with some English friends, did some commissions for the men in the park, and hung about waiting for a freight train to break the track, but eventually, inspirited by the good news from you, left Longmount alone, and for the last time. I little thought that miserable, broiling day on which I arrived at it, with Dr. and Mrs. Hughes, of the glories of which it was the gate, and of the good times I should have. Now I am at home in it. Everyone in it and along the St. Vrain Canyon addresses me in a friendly way by name, and the newspapers, with their intolerable personality, have made me and my writing exploits so notorious that travelers speak courteously to me when they meet me on the prairie, doubtless wishing to see what sort of monster I am. I have met nothing but civility, both of manner and speech, except that distraught pistol shot. It looked icily beautiful, the snow so pure and the sky such a bright, sharp blue. The snow was so deep and level that after a few miles I left the track, and steering for Storm Peak, rode 16 miles over the pathless prairie without seeing man, bird, or beast. A solitude awful even in the bright sunshine. The cold, always great, became piteous. I increased the frostbite of yesterday by exposing my hand in mending the stirrup, and when the sun sank in indescribable beauty behind the mountains, and color rioted in the sky, I got off and walked the last 4 miles, and stole in here in the colored twilight without anyone seeing me. The life of which I wrote before is scarcely less severe, though lighted only by a hope of change, and this weather brings out some special severities. The snow has to be in the living room, the children cannot go out, and good and delightful as they are, it is hard for them to be shut up all day with 4 adults. It is more of a trouble than you would think for a lady in precarious health that before each meal, eggs, butter, milk, preserves, and pickles have to be unfrozen. Unless they are kept on the stove, there is no part of the room in which they do not freeze. It is uninteresting down here in the foothills. I long for the rushing winds, the piled-up peaks, the great pines, the wild night noises, the poetry and the prose of the free, jolly life of my unrivaled Eyrie. I can hardly realize that the river which lies ice-bound outside this house is the same which flashes through Estes Park, and which I saw snow-born on Long's Peak. Yesterday morning the mercury had disappeared, so it was 20 degrees below zero at least. I lay awake from cold all night, but such is the wonderful effect of the climate, that when I got up at 5:30 to waken the household for my early start, I felt quite refreshed. We breakfasted on buffalo beef, and I left at 8 to ride 45 miles before night. Dr. Hughes and a gentleman who was staying there convoying me the first 15 miles. I did like that ride, racing with the other riders, careering through the intoxicating air in that indescribable sunshine, the powdery snow spurned from the horses' feet like dust. I was soon warm. We stopped at a trapper's ranch to feed, and the old trapper amused me by seeming to think Estes Park almost inaccessible in winter. The distance was greater than I had been told, and he said that I could not get there before 11 at night, and not at all if there was much drift. I wanted the gentlemen to go on with me as far as the Devil's Gate, but they could not because their horses were tired, and when the trapper heard that, he exclaimed indignantly, "What? That woman going into the mountains alone? She'll lose the track or be frozen to death." But when I told him I had ridden the trail in the storm of Tuesday, and had ridden over 600 miles alone in the mountains, he treated me with great respect as a fellow mountaineer, and gave me some matches, saying, "You'll have to camp out anyhow. You'd better make a fire than be froze to death." The idea of my spending the night in the forest alone, by a fire, struck me as most grotesque. We did not start again till 1, and the two gentlemen rode the first 2 miles with me. On that track, the little Thompson, there a full stream, has to be crossed 18 times, and they had been hauling wood across it, breaking it, and it had broken and refrozen several times, making thick and thin places. Indeed, there were crossings which even I thought bad, where the ice led us through, and it was hard for the horses to struggle upon it again. And one of the gentlemen, who, though a most accomplished man, was not a horseman, was once or twice in the ludicrous position of hesitating on the bank with an anxious face, not daring to spur his horse upon the ice. After they left me, I had 8 more crossings, and then a ride of 6 miles, before I reached the old trail. But though there were several drifts up to the saddle, and no one had broken a track, Bertie showed such a pluck that instead of spending the night by a campfire, or not getting in till midnight, I reached Mr. Nugent's cabin, 4 miles from Estes Park, only an hour after dark. Very cold, and with the pony so tired that she could hardly put one foot before another. Indeed, I walked the last 3 miles. I saw light through the chinks, but hearing an earnest conversation within, was just about to withdraw, when Ring barked, and on his master coming to the door, I found that the solitary man was talking to his dog. He was looking out for me, and had some coffee ready, and a large fire, which was very pleasant, and I was very glad to get the latest news from the park. He said that Evans told him that it would be most difficult for any one of them to take me down to the plains, but that he would go, which is a great relief. According to the Scotch proverb, better a finger off than a wagon. And as I cannot live here, for you would not like the life or climate, the sooner I leave, the better. The solitary ride to Evans's was very eerie. It was very dark, and the noises were unintelligible. Young Lyman rushed out to take my horse, and the light and warmth within were delightful, but there was a stiffness about the new regime. Evans, though steeped in difficulties, was as hearty and generous as ever. But Edwards, who had assumed the management, is prudent, if not parsimonious, thinks we wasted the supplies recklessly, and the limitations as to milk and so on are painfully apparent. A young ex-guardsman has come up with Evans, of whom the sanguine creature forms great expectations, to be disappointed, doubtless. In the afternoon of yesterday, a gentleman came who I thought was another stranger, strikingly handsome, well-dressed, and barely 40. With 16 shining gold curls falling down his collar, he walked in, and it was only after a careful second look that I recognized in our visitor the redoubtable desperado. Evans courteously pressed him to stay and dine with us, and not only did he show the most singular conversational dexterity in talking with a stranger, who was a very well-informed man, and had seen a great deal of the world, but though he lives and eats like a savage, his manners and way of eating were as refined as possible. I noticed that Evans is never quite himself or perfectly comfortable when he is there, and on the part of the other there is a sort of stiffly assumed cordiality, significant, I fear, of lurking hatred on both sides. I was in the kitchen after dinner making rolled puddings. Young Lyman was eating up the relics as usual. Jim was singing one of Moore's melodies, the others being in the living room, when Mr. Cavan and Mr. Buchan came from up the creek to wish me good-bye. They said it was not half so much like home now, and recalled the good time we had had for 3 weeks. Lyman having lost the cow, we have no more milk. No one makes bread. They dry the venison into chips, and getting the meals at all seems a work of toil and difficulty, instead of the pleasure it used to be to us. Evans, since tea, has told me all his troubles and worries. He is a kind, generous, whole-hearted, unsuspicious man, a worse enemy to himself, I believe, than to any other. But I feel sadly that the future of a man who has no stronger principles than he has must be at the best very insecure. ILB. End of letter 16. Letter 17 of A Lady's Life in the Rocky Mountains. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. A Lady's Life in the Rocky Mountains by Isabella L. Bird. Letter 17. Cheyenne, Wyoming, December 12th. The last evening came. I did not wish to realize it, as I looked at the snowy peaks glistening in the moonlight. No woman will be seen in the park till next May. Young Lyman talked in a highfalutin style, but with some truth in it, of the influence of a woman's presence, how low, mean, vulgar talk had died out on my return, how they had all pulled themselves up, and how Mr. Cavan and Mr. Buchan had said they would like always to be as quiet and gentlemanly as when a lady was with them. By May, he said, we shall be little better than brutes, in our manners at least. I have seen a great deal of the roughest class of men, both on sea and land, during the last 2 years, and the more important I think the mission of every quiet, refined, self-respecting woman, the more mistaken I think those who would forfeit it by noisy self-assertion, masculinity, or fastness. In all this wild West, the influence of woman is second only in its benefits to the influence of religion, and where the last unhappily does not exist, the first continually exerts its restraining power. The last morning came. I cleaned up my room and sat at the window watching the red and gold of one of the most glorious of winter sunrises, and the slow lighting up of one peak after another. I have written that this scenery is not lovable, but I love it. I left on Birdie at 11 o'clock, Evans riding with me as far as Mr. Nugent's. He was telling me so many things that at the top of the hill I forgot to turn round and take a last look at my colossal, resplendent, lonely, sunlit den. But it was needless, for I carry it away with me. I should not have been able to leave if Mr. Nugent had not offered his services. His chivalry to women is so well known that Evans said I could be safer and better cared for with no one. He added, his heart is good and kind, as kind a heart as ever beat. He's a great enemy of his own, but he's been living pretty quietly for the last 4 years. At the door of his den I took leave of Birdie, who had been my faithful companion for more than 700 miles of traveling, and of Evans, who had been uniformly kind to me and just in all his dealings, even to paying to me at that moment the very last dollar he owed me. May God bless him and his. He was obliged to return before I could get off, and as he commended me to Mr. Nugent's care, the two men shook hands kindly. Beginning of footnote. Some months later, Mountain Jim fell by Evans's hand, shot from Evans's doorstep while riding past his cabin. The story of the previous weeks is dark, sad, and evil. Of the five differing versions which have been written to me of the act itself and its immediate causes, it is best to give none. The tragedy is too painful to dwell upon. Jim lived long enough to give his own statement and to appeal to the judgment of God, but died in low delirium before the case reached a human tribunal. End of footnote. Rich spoils of beaver skins were lying on the cabin floor, and the trapper took the finest, a mouse-colored kitten beaver skin, and presented it to me. I hired his beautiful Arab mare, whose springy step and long, easy stride was a relief after Birdie's short, sturdy gait. We had a very pleasant ride, and I seldom had to walk. We took neither of the trails, but cut right through the forest to a place where, through an opening in the foothills, the plain stretched to the horizon covered with snow, the surface of which, having melted and frozen, reflected as water would the pure blue of the sky, presenting a complete optical illusion. It required my knowledge of fact to assure me that I was not looking at the ocean. Jim shortened the way by repeating a great deal of poetry, and by earnest, reasonable conversation, so that I was quite surprised when it grew dark. He told me that he never lay down to sleep without prayer, prayer chiefly that God would give him a happy death. He had previously promised that he would not hurry or scold, but Viking had not been included in the arrangement, and when in the early darkness we reached the steep hill, at whose foot the rapid, deep St. Vrain flows, he fiked unreasonably about me, the mare, and the crossing generally, and seemed to think I could not get through, for the ice had been cut with an axe, and we could not see whether glaze had formed since or not. I was to have slept at the house of a woman farther down the canyon, who never ceases talking, but Miller, the young man whose attractive house and admirable habits I have mentioned before, came out and said his house was now fixed for ladies. So we stayed there, and I was made as comfortable as could be. His house is a model. He cleans everything as soon as it is used, so nothing is ever dirty, and his stove and cooking gear in their bright parts look like polished silver. It was amusing to hear the two men talk like two women about various ways of making bread and biscuits, one even writing out a recipe for the other. It was almost grievous that a solitary man should have the power of making a house so comfortable. They heated a stone for my feet, warmed a blanket for me to sleep in, and put logs enough on the fire to burn all night, for the mercury was 11 below zero. The stars were intensely bright, and a well-defined auroral arch, throwing off fantastic coruscations, lighted the whole northern sky. Yet I was only in the foothills, and Long's glorious peak was not to be seen. Miller had all his things washed up and his pots and pans cleaned in 10 minutes after supper, and then had the whole evening in which to smoke and enjoy himself. A poor woman would probably have been fussing around till 10 o'clock about the same work. Besides Ring, there was another gigantic dog craving for notice, and two large cats, which, the whole evening, were on their master's knee. Cold as the night was, the house was chinked, and the rooms felt quite warm. I even missed the free currents of air which I had been used to. This was my last evening in what may be called a mountainous region. The next morning, as soon as the sun was well risen, we left for our journey of 30 miles, which had to be done nearly at a foot's pace, owing to one horse being encumbered with my luggage. I did not wish to realize that it was my last ride, and my last association with any of the men of the mountains whom I had learned to trust, and in some respects to admire. No more hunters' tales told while the pine knots crack and blaze, no more thrilling narratives of adventures with Indians and bears, and never again shall I hear that strange talk of nature and her doings which is the speech of those who live with her and her alone. Already the dismalness of a level land comes over me. The canyon of the St. Vrain was in all its glory of color, but we had a remarkably ugly crossing of that brilliant river, which was frozen all over, except an unpleasant gap of about 2 feet in the middle. Mr. Nugent had to drive the frightened horses through, while I, having crossed on some logs lower down, had to catch them on the other side as they plunged to shore trembling with fear. Then we emerged on the vast expanse of the glittering plains, and a sudden sweep of wind made the cold so intolerable that I had to go into a house to get warm. This was the last house we saw till we reached our destination that night. I never saw the mountain range look so beautiful, uplifted in every shade of transparent blue, till the sublimity of Long's Peak and the lofty crest of Storm's Peak bore only unsullied snow against the sky. Peaks gleamed in living light, canyons lay in depths of purple shade. 100 miles away, Pike's Peak rose a lump of blue, and over all, through that glorious afternoon, a veil of blue spiritualized without dimming the outlines of that most glorious range, making it look like the dreamed-of mountains of the land which is very far off, till at sunset it stood out sharp in glories of violet and opal, and the whole horizon up to a great height was suffused with the deep rose and pure orange of the afterglow. It seemed all dreamlike as we passed through the sunlit solitude, on the right the prairie waves lessening towards the far horizon, while on the left they broke in great snowy surges against the Rocky Mountains. All that day we neither saw man, beast, nor bird. Jim was silent mostly. Like all true children of the mountains, he pined even when temporarily absent from them. At sunset, we reached a cluster of houses called Namaqua, where, to my dismay, I heard that there was to be a dance at the one little inn to which we were going at St. Louis. I pictured to myself no privacy, no peace, no sleep, drinking, low sounds, and worse than all, Jim getting into a quarrel and using his pistols. He was uncomfortable about it for another reason. He said he had dreamt the night before that there was to be a dance, and that he had to shoot a man for making an unpleasant remark. For the last 3 miles which we accomplished after sunset, the cold was most severe, but nothing could exceed the beauty of the afterglow, and the strange look of the rolling plains of snow beneath it. When we got to the queer little place where they keep strangers at St. Louis, they were very civil, and said that after supper we could have the kitchen to ourselves. I found a large prononcé, competent, bustling widow, hugely stout, able to manage all men and everything else, and a very florid sister like herself, top-heavy with hair. There were besides 2 naughty children in the kitchen, who cried incessantly, and kept opening and shutting the door. There was no place to sit down but a wooden chair by the side of the kitchen stove, at which supper was being cooked for 10 men. The bustle and clatter were indescribable, and the landlady asked innumerable questions, and seemed to fill the whole room. The only expedient for me, for the night, was to sleep on a shakedown in a very small room occupied by the 2 women and the children, and even this was not available till midnight, when the dance terminated. And there was no place in which to wash except a bowl in the kitchen. I sat by the stove till supper, wearying of the noise and bustle, after the quiet of Estes Park. The landlady asked, with great eagerness, who the gentleman was who was with me, and said that the men outside were saying that they were sure that it was Rocky Mountain Jim, but she was sure it was not. When I told her that the men were right, she exclaimed, "Do tell! I want to know that quiet, kind gentleman." And she said she used to frighten her children, when they were naughty, by telling them that he would get them, for he came down from the mountains every week and took back a child with him to eat. She was as proud of having him in her house as if he had been the president, and I gained a reflected importance. All the men in the settlement assembled in the front room, hoping he would go and smoke there, and when he remained in the kitchen, they came round the window and into the doorway to look at him. The children got on his knee, and to my great relief he kept them good and quiet, and let them play with his curls, to the great delight of the two women, who never took their eyes off him. At last the bad-smelling supper was served, and 10 silent men came in and gobbled it up, staring steadily at Jim as they gobbled. Afterwards there seemed no hope of quiet, so we went to the post-office, and while waiting for stamps were shown into the prettiest and most ladylike-looking room I have seen in the West, created by a pretty and refined-looking woman. She made an opportunity for asking me if it were true that the gentleman with me was Mountain Jim, and added that so very gentlemanly a person could not be guilty of the misdeeds attributed to him. When we returned, the kitchen was much quieter. It was cleared by 8, as the landlady promised. We had it to ourselves till 12, and could scarcely hear the music. It was a most respectable dance, a fortnightly gathering got up by the neighboring settlers, most of them young, married people, and there was no drinking at all. I wrote to you for some time, while Mr. Nugent copied for himself the poems In the Glen and the latter half of The River Without a Bridge, which he recited with deep feeling. It was altogether very quiet and peaceful. He repeated to me several poems of great merit which he had composed, and told me much more about his life. I knew that no one else could or would speak to him as I could, and for the last time I urged upon him the necessity of a reformation in his life, beginning with the giving up of whiskey, going so far as to tell him that I despised a man of his intellect for being a slave to such a vice. "Too late, too late," he always answered, "for such a change." Aye, too late. He shed tears quietly. "It might have been once," he said. "Aye, might have been." He has excellent sense for everyone but himself, and as I have seen him with a single exception, a gentleness, propriety, and considerateness of manner surprising in any man, but especially so in a man associating only with the rough men of the West. As I looked at him, I felt a pity such as I never before felt for a human being. My thought at that moment was, "Will not our Father in heaven, who spared not his own Son, but delivered him up for us all, be far more pitiful?" For the time a desire for self-respect, better aspirations, and even hope itself entered his dark life, and he said suddenly that he had made up his mind to give up whiskey and his reputation as a desperado. But it is too late. A little before 12 the dance was over, and I got to the crowded little bedroom, which only allowed of one person standing in it at a time, to sleep soundly and dream of 99 just persons who need no repentance. The landlady was quite taken up with her distinguished guest. That kind, quiet gentleman, Mountain Jim, well, I never, he must be a very good man. Yesterday morning the mercury was 20 degrees below zero. I think I never saw such a brilliant atmosphere. That curious phenomenon called frostfall was occurring, in which whatever moisture may exist in the air somehow aggregates into feathers and fern leaves, the loveliest of creations, only seen in rarefied air and intense cold. One breath and they vanish. The air was filled with diamond sparks quite intangible. They seemed just to glitter and no more. It was still and cloudless, and the shapes of violet mountains were softened by a veil of the tenderest blue. When the Greeley stage wagon came up, Mr. Fodder, whom I met at Lower Canyon, was on it. He had expressed a great wish to go to Estes Park and to hunt with Mountain Jim, if it would be safe to do the latter. He was now dressed in the extreme of English dandyism, and when I introduced them he put out a small hand cased in a perfectly fitting lemon-colored kid glove. Beginning a footnote. This was a truly unfortunate introduction. It was the first link in the chain of circumstances which brought about Mr. Nugent's untimely end. and it was at this person's instigation, when overcome by fear, that Evans fired that shot which proved fatal. End of footnote. As the trapper stood there in his grotesque rags and odds and ends of apparel, his gentlemanliness of deportment brought into relief the innate vulgarity of a rich parvenu. Mr. Fodder rattled so amusingly as we drove away that I never realized that my Rocky Mountain life was at an end, not even when I saw Mountain Jim, with his golden hair, yellow in the sunshine, slowly leading the beautiful mare over the snowy plains back to Estes Park, equipped with the saddle on which I had ridden 800 miles. A drive of several hours over the plains brought us to Greeley, and a few hours later, in the far blue distance, the Rocky Mountains, and all that they enclose, went down beyond the prairie sea. ILB. End of letter 17. End of A Lady's Life in the Rocky Mountains by Isabella L. Byrd.
Save big this holiday season. All in the Kroger app.
Buy two, get three free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up. Then get a flavorful Kroger spiral sliced ham for 89 cents a pound with an additional $25 purchase. Limit two, all with your card.
Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.